with a group like this, I'm going to take it for granted that I don't need to persuade you about the reality of climate change or how important it is. In fact, I don't want to say much about climate change at all, except to make three very quick points. Number one, it really does seem to be the greatest challenge that humanity has faced, at least since civilizations began to form. Number two, one of the really interesting things about it is that it's not something that's happening to us, it's something that we're doing to ourselves. I mean, it's quite striking. We can't blame any other species. It's us. It seems sort of the best possible example of sort of collective karma. But it also points, you could say, to the fact that the problem is that it does seem to point to some basic inadequacy of the way that our civilization is organized. For example, it's that the people who basically have the most say about what goes on, the people who basically control the world, are also the ones who are benefiting the most from the present system. So, right? I mean, that's a problem. And thirdly, although our collective response to it isn't negligible, nonetheless, it seems to be far from what's actually necessary. I mean, we're not really doing quickly enough to really resolve the problem. Bill McKibben recently published an article with the title, "If We Win Slowly, We Lose." It's not clear if we're winning, but if we are, it's slowly, and we're losing. And why is that? But what's really interesting, I think, and the first point that I really want to focus on is that those three points that I've just said about climate change, what a global warming, kind of euphemisms for what we should be talking about in terms of climate breakdown, climate emergency, something like that. These three points about climate change actually apply to something much broader as well, what we could call the larger ecological crisis. And this needs to be emphasized because otherwise we might think that, you know, if we can just convert to renewable sources of energy quickly enough that our civilization can kind of go on the way that it has been. And it just ain't the case. Right? The truth is climate change is just the tip of an iceberg, a much larger iceberg, which for the moment I'll identify as an ecological crisis. For example, looking at the oceans. Certainly, the increased carbon in the atmosphere and the increased temperatures, that has certainly affected the oceans, right? One recent figure, this may be a bit high, but I read that over 90% of all the heat that has been generated over the last couple generations has been absorbed by the oceans. And if the oceans weren't there, average global temperatures would have gone up over, get this, 90 degrees, and we would all be literally toast. So thank goodness for the oceans. But that excess heat and also the kind of excess carbon, which is acidifying things, okay, that's destroying coral reefs. It's badly damaging the phytoplankton at the sort of source of the food chain. They can't form the shells that they need when the ocean is becoming so acid, and so forth. So climate change is affecting the oceans for sure, but we can't blame everything that's happening there on climate change. For example, it's been estimated that the way things are going now, by the year 2048, the oceans will basically be commercially fished out. We won't be able to use them as a source of food anymore. And it's also been estimated that by 2050, there will be more plastic in the oceans than fish. Plastics have only been around a couple generations. Problem is, they don't degrade. They kind of break up into ever smaller pieces. In fact, it now turns out that some of those tinier and tinier pieces are in our drinking water. Over 90% of all of the public drinking water in the U.S., they have little tiny pieces of plastic in them. Very, very tiny. I think you need a microscope. In the middle of the Pacific is the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, right? The way the current goes, it concentrates the plastic in the middle. So there are deserted islands where no one ever goes that are literally covered with plastic refuse. It breaks up into littler and littler pieces that are ingested by the sea life. I mean, add to that these dead spots, the pollution that gets into rivers, you know, forming algae blooms and such, the fertilizers and the pesticides. There are hundreds all around the world where the rivers enter the ocean. One of the biggest is at the mouth of the Mississippi. Last summer, I think it was the biggest ever, measured as 8,770 some square miles. Dead zone. No fish, nothing can live there. Can we just blame that on climate change? And so many more things. Perhaps the most important, or the one that stands out the most from a Buddhist perspective, it's what's happening, what's being called the sixth great extinction event. The fact that in the pursuit of our own interest in treating the rest of the globe as simply there for us to use for our own benefit, we're causing the extinctions of large numbers of plant and animal species. E.O. Wilson, the renowned Harvard biologist, estimated at one time that by the end of the century, half of all the world's plant and animal species could be extinct or will be so weak, so weakened that they will go extinct soon thereafter. What does that mean, especially for a tradition like Zen or Buddhism generally, where we take vows to save all sentient beings, when we as a civilization seem to be doing our best to destroy as many as we can? There are so many more things one could go on about. Let me just read you one little bit from a Yale professor. James Gustav Speth, from a book he published in 2008, The Bridge at the End of the World. Half the world's tropical and temperate forests are now gone. The rate of deforestation in the tropics continues at about an acre per second and has for decades. Half the planet's wetlands are gone. An estimated 90% of the large predator fish are gone. And 75% of marine fisheries are now overfished or fished to capacity. About half the corals are gone or are seriously threatened. Anyone see that new documentary about corals? Chasing corals? Yeah. Basically half have died in the last 30 years and they expect the other half to die in the next 30 years. Species are disappearing at rates about 1,000 times faster than normal. The planet hasn't seen such a spasm of extinction in 65 million years since the dinosaurs. Desertification claims a Nebraska-sized area of productivity each year globally. Persistent toxic chemicals are now found by the dozens in essentially each and every one of us. And he goes on and on. In the last 40 years, we've lost about one-third of the world's cropland. Can you believe that? Just in 40 years. At the same time, of course, the population is probably another billion people, at least. All we have to do, he says, to destroy the planet's climate and biota and leave a ruined world to our children and grandchildren is to keep doing exactly what we are doing today, with no growth in human population or the world economy. Just continue to generate greenhouse gases at current rates, just continue to impoverish ecosystems and release toxic chemicals at current rates, and the world in the latter part of this century won't be fit to live in. But human activities are not holding at current levels. They're accelerating dramatically. So he published this in 2008, 10 years ago. And of course, since then, population is growing. As we know, the economy well bounced back from the Great Recession. It's continuing to explode. So we're not holding constant. What does this mean, generally and for Buddhism specifically? I think that the whole of the ecological crisis, too, is a kind of a symptom of something deeper. So you got the climate change, ecological crisis, but even those, if you think of it as an iceberg, those are above water. There's something else going on. I tend to think of them as a very clear symptom, like a warning sign of a now global civilization that has lost its way. That is so preoccupied with exponential economic growth and consumption, kind of trapped into that, that it has become self-destructive. So it's quite interesting for Buddhism. Buddhism, including Zen, but not only Zen. So now Buddhism comes to not just the West, but to the modern world. Right? I mean, Buddhism is always spread mostly through peaceful means, interacting with the local cultures. So now Buddhism comes and faces its greatest challenge ever in the modern world, not just the West, a globalizing civilization, secular, ravenous in its economic growth. And as I suspect, and as I said, and I think it's really true, there's something self-destructive about this. I'm talking about the ecological. We could certainly add other social and political issues. But the real question this raises for us, okay, what does this mean for Buddhism? What does Buddhism have to contribute, but also what does Buddhism have to learn from this? What does this situation, this new situation, which Buddhism and Zen have never faced before, what does this new situation mean for how we practice? For how we understand what it is that we're doing when we sit here. The problem, the larger problem, seems to be that we're kind of trapped in an economic system that has to keep growing if it's not going to collapse. We're all aware, I think, of how much the gap between rich and poor is growing very rapidly. Ever since communism collapsed in the early 90s, sort of capitalism, it feels to me, has sort of taken off its velvet gloves. Anybody else notice the statistic last week or a week before that over the last year, with the economic, mainly stock market boom, right? The wealthiest 500 billionaires have increased their collective wealth. Just in the last year, those 500, they've increased their collective wealth $1 trillion. That is to say, on average, each of those 500 billionaires had his or her net worth increase by $2 billion. Again, what does this mean? What kind of civilization? And if you look at where that increase comes from, of course, it's mostly the stock market has been booming, hasn't it? And when you look at the stock market, how it works, it's all about future expectations, right? Future profitability, future growth. And then, of course, you got the whole debt system where there's so much debt involved, and in order to pay back the debt, you've got to earn more money. So again, this system that has to keep growing if it's not going to collapse. And the question I raise again, what does this mean for our practice? Do we see our practice as a refuge from this? Something that allows us to sort of not think about it, you know, just don't bother me? Or what does this situation imply, given the emphasis in Buddhism on dukkha, suffering, and responding to the suffering? I'm heartened by the fact that in the last few years, maybe the last 4 or 5 years, interest in eco-dharma has really developed, I think, pretty quickly. By eco-dharma, fairly new term, right? Ecological dharma, the ecological implications of Buddhism, Buddhism as applied to our ecological situation, right? This has really developed very quickly, I think, in the last 4 or 5 years. One sign of that is this new Eco-Dharma Center. Are you familiar with this? This new Eco-Dharma Center that we've just started in the last year or so. There's some brochures in the living room. Things are happening there, but I'm also struck by the fact that it's taking Buddhists so long to become concerned about this. You know, I've been trying to talk about it for many, many years, and it's only in the last few years that it's getting traction. Seems like there were so many times I was offering workshops or workshop retreats on social and ecological issues, and quite a few of them were canceled or should have been canceled because so few people signed up. You know, the interest just wasn't there. I mean, the ecological crisis has been front page news since, you know, Rachel Carson in the 50s, right? Silent Spring. The EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, started in the 60s. James Hansen was in 87, first talking to Congress about climate change, how urgent it was. 91, 92, the Rio Climate Change Conference. There was a while there. Many of you are too young to notice this. There was a while there right after Rio when it was like everything was about this and it was front page news, and then it just sort of fell away. So here we are, 2018. I mean, I used to wonder, well, maybe it's just me. Maybe my way of talking about these issues isn't what people are so interested in, but it's quite striking. A lot of the interest that's grown in the last few years has been among Buddhist teachers. And they also report the same thing. Even now, if they announce a week ahead or so that there's going to be a talk on eco-dharma, guess what? The number of people who come to the talk is considerably less than usual. Interesting. Why not? Does it make us uncomfortable in some way? No. Again, do we see our practice as kind of a refuge from having to think about things like that? Just as climate change is just a small part of the larger ecological crisis, so ecodharma can be understood as a part of the larger issue of social engagement generally, right? Social, economic, political issues, socially engaged Buddhism. It's striking that in the wake of the Great Recession, 2008-2009, the two largest, most visible socially engaged organizations, right? Zen Peacemakers and Bernie Glassman's. Mm-hmm. And also Buddhist Peace Fellowship, right? They basically both kind of collapsed because of lack of funding. Their funding dried up. I mean, they survive and they're doing really well given very limited resources, but they're much smaller than they were. At the same time, there's lots of money available for certain sort of large meditation centers. I'm thinking of Spirit Rock, where I've been a couple times. A great place in many ways. They just had this huge expansion campaign, raised millions and millions and millions of dollars to build some more buildings. Good for them. I'm not criticizing that, but I'm just struck that the money is there to create these centers, but it's not there to support, you know, pretty lean, socially engaged Buddhist organizations. Mm-hmm. Why not? In some ways, I wonder if socially engaged Buddhism has been, to some degree, a victim of its own success. In the sense that something is now generally accepted that wasn't, say, a generation ago. That is to say that, say, prison dharma or hospice work or helping homeless people. I think it's now generally accepted this can be, you know, part of the bodhisattva path. This can be an important part of our path, right? But it's interesting how, let me say it this way. I think we've gotten a lot better at pulling drowning people out of the river, one by one. But Buddhism and Buddhists generally aren't much better at asking why it is there are so many people drowning in the river. Who or what is pushing them in the river upstream? Right? And I can understand that in a way. It's like our practice emphasizes immediacy. Right? You're there, you walk down the street, you see somebody lying down, maybe ill, homeless. We're taught to respond to the situation. Right? There's a person in need. So we respond to that. But, you know, asking why there are so many people in the river, what it is about the river, that's more difficult. In a way, our practice doesn't train us for that. It's more conceptual. It's more, right? Our practice doesn't help us go there. We have to ask what's wrong with our economic and political system. If we want to address this kind of dukkha, it's like the whole practice has been individual dukkha suffering. That's the tradition that Buddhism focuses on. And when we look at structural, social, institutional, there's not much in the tradition that the Zen or the other Buddhist traditions in Asia that sort of help us go there. There was a Brazilian archbishop, I forget his name now, but maybe it's not essential. He said, when I give food to the poor, they call me a saint. When I ask why there are so many poor, they call me a communist. Is there a Buddhist version? when we help, when we go into prisons or hospice work, we're called bodhisattvas. But when we want to ask the larger structural issues, oh, don't bring in your lefty radical politics here. That has nothing to do with Buddhism. Given the situation that Buddhism is confronting now, given the world that these wonderful traditions are now coming into, can we really avoid those questions anymore? Don't we need to ask what it is within our traditions that can give us a perspective on what's going on and help us to address it? And of course, we can also ask the other question. We can turn it around and ask, in a way, this is what I'm doing. What does the kind of ecological and social crisis that we're facing now, what does that imply for how we understand and practice Buddhism? So socially engaged Buddhism, still not very well funded, still kind of small. At the same time, something else, of course, in the last decade or so has really exploded, right? Huge. Anybody guess what I'm talking about here? The sort of impact of Buddhism? That's a real question, not just a rhetorical. Anybody?
Secular mindfulness.
So, the mindfulness movement, yeah? It's quite interesting. It's like social engagement, no, but mindfulness, whoa, whoa. That kind of fits very nicely into our sort of individualistic, can sort of help the individual quality of my life, but it doesn't have much of a social, at least a direct social impact. Now, please don't misunderstand me. I think the mindfulness movement is, for the most part, really good. Although there's very big problems sometimes in relation to sort of corporations, you know. You get the sense sometimes that rather than actually improving the quality of life for the employee, maybe the employee who's working too much, instead of doing that, well, let's send him or her on a mindfulness course to help them cope better, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, in other words, using mindfulness to help the corporation, to help employees be more productive and effective, and to help the corporation be more profitable. So these kinds of issues that have been talked about are certainly things that we need to look at. But notice the contrast. Social engagement, including eco-dharma, pretty small. Mindfulness movement exploding. Here's my question. What is it within our traditions, Zen and otherwise, Buddhist and otherwise, what is it that can help us understand why the one is so successful and why the other is having such trouble? And that's what I want to spend the rest of my time talking about. Maybe a reality check. Are you following me here okay? Is it making sense so far? A few years ago, I was reading a book by an academic called Loyal Rue, teaches Luther College in Iowa, a book called Everybody's Story, about evolution, quite interesting, but it includes cultural evolution. And in that book, I came across a passage that literally stopped me in my tracks, because it expressed so well a discomfort that I was feeling about Buddhism, or at least certain types of Buddhism. I thought he really nailed it. And basically what he said in this passage, and I don't have to quote it, it's kind of academic the way he puts it, but basically he's saying that spiritual traditions like Christianity and Buddhism in the future, they will become less influential because basically they don't have what it takes to address the kinds of social and ecological problems we have today. And he specified two things in particular, which were what so impressed me. He said, why are they going to become less influential? Why are they unable to engage with these kinds of issues? Two reasons, he says. One, cosmological dualism. Don't worry, I'll explain it. And number two, individual salvation. And I thought, whoa, he's onto something there. Right? Cosmological dualism. Well, maybe easier to see in relation to something like, say, Christianity, right? This world, you got God, you got heaven. In a way, as we hear, right? In a way, that there's a higher world, and inevitably, it devalues this world to some extent. This was kind of a means to an end, right? For a lot of Christians, the idea is to behave ourselves here so that we can qualify for eternity with God in heaven, right? So, in a way, this world is devalued to that extent. It's not an end in itself. It's a means to something better and greater, right? Of course, we don't have anything like that in Buddhism, right? Well, in early Buddhism, I mean, if you look at... I mean, there's a lot of ambiguity in the Pali Canon, I think, about the nature of Nibbana. When you really try to, you know, what is it? It doesn't say. It's mostly negative, right? And Nibbana is the end of suffering, the end of craving, the end of... But it's an island, a refuge, etc. It's very hard to get a sense of what Nibbana really means, but the way the early traditions understood it, the whole point is this world of samsara, the world of suffering, the world of craving, the world of delusion. This is the problem, and the goal is not to be reborn. Right? So that when you die, you're not going to be reborn. Presumably, you're in some better place or something, but in any case, you have escaped, you have transcended this world of samsara. Well, that's cosmological dualism. But what about Zen? We're not cosmological dualists in that sense, but I ask you to reflect on the way that we understand emptiness. How much is emptiness a kind of refuge from the messy social, ecological, economic world, right? How do we understand emptiness? Realizing emptiness, again, I'm not going to go into the nitty-gritty. Although I think it's really interesting. I think that there's a lot that needs to be said there. But I want to switch to the second point. Not only cosmological dualism, but individual salvation, right? Like in Christianity, you're saved one by one, right? You die, and St. Peter, he reads the book of what you did and all that, and if you pass, you can go in, right? And in a way, it's your own individual life. Buddhism, well, how do we understand awakening? How do we understand enlightenment, right? One by one. I mean, we have the Bodhisattva path, too, the idea that somehow our awakening is connected with something greater. But nonetheless, how much of our practice, how much of our orientation is fundamentally, hey, it's about me. It's about my own realization. It's about my own enlightenment. It's about my own serenity, my own equanimity or peace of mind. So I think that there are not, maybe we can't call them cosmological dualism, but there's something even in Zen that depending on how it's understood, can encourage us to disengage. But of course, in the modern world, in the Western educated world, a lot of us aren't so sure what we think about the traditional stories about samsara, nirvana, and transcending or escaping this world. So it's not surprising that as Buddhism has entered into the US and to the modern world, it's been psychologized. We tend to understand it. And I think this is maybe the place where Buddhism has interacted the most. We know there are many psychotherapists who are practitioners and include certain types of mindfulness practices in their practice. Some of them are even teachers, right? But the point of psychologization is that it's not so much about transcending the world, but fitting into it better, right? It's like, the problem, what's the problem? Well, the problem is the way my mind works. Maybe the problem is my traumas from childhood or whatever. And through the practice, we can get a grip on those, become aware of those, let them go. It's interesting. In Asia, there's not much talk about, in the Asian traditions, very little talk about emotions. They tend to be understood, you know, as afflictive, the problematic. And if you just meditate long enough, you know, you kind of let them go. I think it's been an important development in the westernization of Buddhism that we're aware that sometimes it's not that easy, that you can get into a kind of spiritual bypassing, that sometimes it can be very valuable with psychology to sort of deal with these issues. Combining certain types of therapy with practice can be much more powerful than just the practice by itself. Yeah. But the basic idea in this psychologization is, the fundamental problem is my mind, the way my mind works, and if I can just sort that out, then hey, I will become happier, more equanimous. It'll help me be a better spouse, better parent, better friend, better worker. It's, you know, all of these things. My life will go better within the society. Notice the contrast. The traditional idea in Asia, largely, is that somehow to transcend the world, transcend this world. Even in Zen, the emptiness can be understood as a kind of a, that which enables us to transcend the everyday nitty-gritty. In contrast, in the modern world, it's not so much transcending the world, but fitting into it better. Right? Opposites. Opposite goals. Opposite in one way, but what is it that they agree on? In one way, they're not opposites at all. Mm-hmm. How do they agree with each other? Neither one of them encourages us to engage with the world. Mm-hmm. You know, whether the world is, I mean, in a way, they both take the world for granted. It's samsara, oh my God, let's get out of here. Or, you know, it's we're deluded by form, let's go dwell in emptiness. Or, the world is just what it is. Let's sort out our minds so that we can function better within the world. But neither one of them encourages us to actually engage with it. Neither one of them encourages us to, as Buddhist practitioners, to engage with the kinds of social and ecological and political and economic issues which are really, and I really think this is true, we're on a self-destructive path. You know? Again, this question, what does our practice have to do with it? Anyway, so whether you see Buddhism as a way to transcend this world of samsara or to fit into it better, I think that encourages a very particular way of resolving the ecological crisis. I think Buddhism, we figured out our own solution. I'm serious about this. Mm-hmm. We have our own solution, and it goes something like this. When I read, as I did last week, how much the world's temperature would have gone up if it weren't for the oceans, or I read about the 500 billionaires who are now $1 trillion richer, when I read about this, when I read about the sixth great extinction event, etc., when I read about the tiny plastic particles in over 90% of our public drinking water, how do I feel? How do you feel? Let me guess. You probably feel kind of the same way. It's sad? Depressed? Nihilistic? Frustrated? But hey, we're Buddhist practitioners. We know what to do when we feel like this. Let's go to the Zendo. Let's meditate for 40, 45 minutes. Let's let go of these feelings. Let's let go of these ways of thinking. We meditate for 40 minutes, we let them go. We've solved the problem. We get up and we feel better. Does that ring a bell? Is there some truth in that? Something about the way that we use our practice? Does our practice, is it something that helps us engage, or is it something that helps us disengage? And I don't mean to criticize the meditation. I'm not by any means saying we shouldn't be meditating, but I'm saying what's the larger role of that within our lives? Of course, there's another way to understand what this path is about. And let me just conclude by saying just a few words about it. Basically, I'm just going to be sharing what it seems like to me. I mean, I think the Buddhist path is all about deconstructing and reconstructing the sense of self in relationship to the world, something like that. The deconstruction is what's going on when we're meditating. And the reconstruction is the true meaning of karma. I mean, I think we've misunderstood karma. I think the fundamental teaching there that the Buddha emphasized, and this was part of his revolutionary transformation, was the emphasis on intentionality, how it is that, you know, by transforming our intentions, transforming our fundamental motivations, how will not only act in the world differently, but we will literally experience the world in a different way. If I'm motivated by greed, ill will, delusion, I'm going to be experiencing you and the world in a very different way than if I'm motivated by generosity, loving kindness, and wisdom. This kind of deconstruction isn't something, or reconstruction, it's not something that has to happen after the deconstruction. I mean, I think these two things go on and on. When we're meditating, in a way, we're deconstructing, right? The sense of self, it's composed of mostly habitual, psychological, and physical processes, habits, tendencies. When we're meditating, we're letting them go, like Dogen said. To study or to investigate the Buddha Dharma is really to investigate the nature of the self, and the whole point of our practice is about that. And how do we do it? It's by forgetting ourselves. It's about letting go of these habitual processes that normally function, interact in a certain way. And in particular, what they construct is the sense of separation. The feeling that there's a me inside and the rest of the world is outside. And as I like to say, the way I understand dukkha is, as long as we have this sense of separation, as long as there's this constructed sense of self, because it's not a real self, it's always going to feel empty. It's always going to feel uncomfortable, insecure, anxious, because it doesn't have any reality and there's nothing there that could become real. So this sense of separation is the fundamental problem. And the kind of awakening and transformation is dissolving, is in part dissolving the sense of separation, so that we experience the world in a more non-dual way. There's that great line by Nisargadatta: when I look inside and see that I am nothing, that's wisdom. When I look outside and see that I am everything, that's love. Between these two, my life turns. My life flows. Wisdom and love, or wisdom and compassion, the two pillars of our path. And I love the way he shows the relationship, right? Letting go of the sense of separate self. There's a kind of wisdom, fundamental wisdom there. And the wisdom that is liberating, because there's no longer the delusion of a self that's always preoccupied with trying to secure itself, trying to secure something that can never be secured. But how does that play out in how we actually live in the world? Well, he calls it love. That love, that compassion, is how that non-dual insight, the realization that I'm not separate from the world, how does that actually affect, transform how I live in the world and how I relate to other people? And he calls it love. Love here is not just some, it's not just a feeling, it's a way of being in the world that follows, that accompanies that realization. So, the path as deconstructing the sense of separate self, which is what's going on when we're meditating, and reconstructing in terms of how we learn to engage in the world in a new way. And I talk about it in terms of deconstructing the sense of self, but of course it's all about relationship. So deconstructing the sense of subjective self is also going to be deconstructing the objectivity, the idea that the world is out there separate from me. You see, it's really going to involve a transformation. Yeah. And in Buddhism, we talk about it in terms of realizing emptiness and lots of other things, lots of other ways. But my final point, if this way of understanding our path works, if this is true, then I think this makes it clearer how the kind of transformation and the reconstruction that's going on, that it's not something that just happens individually. In other words, personal, individual transformation here, we can see how this interacts with the larger social. It's not just that we ourselves need to be deconstructed and reconstructed in order to resolve what Buddhism traditionally calls our dukkha, our suffering in the broad sense, right? It's not just on the individual level. But when we let go of ourselves and our self-preoccupation and our basic kind of narcissism, you know, what's in it for me, my own enlightenment, when we're really able to let that go, we can see that the kind of transformation and reconstruction that's necessary to deal with dukkha is not just me, but especially at this particular point in time, we can see this is something that has to apply to society, to our civilization as a whole, because as I started out by saying, you know, we have created a monstrosity of a civilization that's self-deconstructing. So what we see here then is that the path of personal transformation and the path of social and ecological transformation, that these two paths are two sides of the same thing. And we have a word for that in Buddhism. It's the bodhisattva. It's the bodhisattva path. Because the bodhisattva has a double practice. He or she continues to work on their own. They still have their own meditation practice, to work on their own realization, their own insight. At the same time, they know that that's in and of itself insufficient, that we also need to engage. Traditionally in Asia, what was emphasized is individual, helping people wake, other people wake up. But it's really become clear, I think, that here we also need to find ways to look at the larger social patterns and engage with that, so that the true bodhisattva we need today is the someone who's devoted to their own transformation and also to the larger social transformation. If we're going to make it through this mess that we're in, with anything like a civilization or any kind of civilization that we would want to live in. Does it make sense? As usual, I've totally lost track of the time. Does anyone else, Matt, do you have any sense how we're doing with time?
Yeah, there's a clock above your head. You just can't see. I think it's been about close to an hour.
So the question is, do we want to have a little bit of a discussion here, or should we go have tea, and then those who want to discuss, we could continue there? Maybe that's a better thing. What do you think?
Maybe it
is. Yeah, people have been sitting cross-legged for a long time. So why don't we adjourn, enjoy some tea, and I'll be there, and we can, if anyone wants to follow up on this. I also brought a few books if anyone's interested. Thank you for your attention.